From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how cities have responded to defund the police campaigns.
The idea of including more social workers in responding to emergency calls has been relatively popular. Ann Arbor, Sterling Heights, Lansing, Livonia, and Grand Rapids all plan to add either social workers or other mental health professionals.
But by far, most cities are increasing funding for law enforcement. Also, the state lifts rules on public interactions despite a wide segment of vaccine-hesitant Michiganders.
I know a lot of people who are hesitant to get the vaccine, like way more people than I would have maybe anticipated at the start of the pandemic.
Plus, frustrating interactions for trans people at the doctor's office.
Providers have to work from healthcare training to work with a gender identity.
We have those stories coming up this hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to check out the low vaccination rates among Detroit's police force. The trend isn't great, but it seems to track with how people overall in the city feel about vaccines.
Police officers are just like regular people. They have the same fears and concerns and motivations for wanting or not wanting the vaccine as every other Detroiter.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, may not feel like this outside right now, but a new year is about to begin for many cities in Michigan, a new fiscal year. Cities revise their budgets all throughout the year, but July 1st marks the starting point of a new fiscal year for most of our cities. And as those budget plans get finalized, our team has been digging into how cities are handling calls to defund police. Michigan Radio's newsroom analysis shows that out of Michigan's 20 largest cities, almost all plan to spend more money on police in the coming year, not less. Here to talk with us about what we found is our data reporter, Nisa Khan. Hey, Nisa.
Hi, happy to be here.
And West Michigan reporter Dustin Dwyer's here as well. Hey, Dustin.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad. Dustin, a lot of people first heard about the movement to defund policing after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And we all saw the demonstrations in the streets in Michigan last year. But how much did this movement really affect things in city halls?
It affected them a lot. And in more than a few cities, this was the topic that residents were calling into city council meetings the most about. I live in Grand Rapids and I follow Grand Rapids City Council meetings. So I knew about this and heard about it nearly every meeting. But in doing the reporting for this, we also have this new tool at Michigan Radio. We call it Minutes, and it generates these automated transcripts of city council meetings. And we were able to search the transcripts of all these meetings. You just find mention after mention of police budgets, people calling in to say what they think about police budgets, and in many cities calling to defund the police budgets. I brought you a sampling of some of the comments we heard. Here's one. Here's Yvonne Jones. She called into a Detroit City Council meeting in April.
It is time for us to look at these budgets closely. The police budget needs to be defunded. There's too much money being spent on the police and not enough on the people of Detroit.
And here's another sample from a woman who called into the Lansing City Council meeting. She gave her name as Danielle.
And so I'm pleading with you, please do not give this money to them without the stipulation that it has to go towards mental health help and real mental health help. That's not just if you're crazy, we'll shoot you. And that's our way of dealing with you.
So in cities like Detroit, Dearborn, Lansing, Kalamazoo, and Grand Rapids, we heard a lot of calls to defund police, and they far exceeded the calls that supported the police. But there were still a lot of people who called into city council meetings who did support police. And you could hear that especially in, say, Flint, where residents complained of rising crime, gunfire, and drag races in the streets. And here's one resident who called into Flint City Council meeting on May 24th. Her name is Tanya Burns.
We need to have a hiring campaign, a massive hiring campaign for police officers. We need to make sure that we're offering them some incentives. We need to make sure that we're offering them a livable wage.
So you did hear the conversation. There were people sort of on both sides, but in many cities, in most cities in Michigan, the calls to defund definitely outweighed the calls for supporting police.
Nisa, you've been actually digging into the numbers for city budgets. Were you able to find any cities that actually are defunding their police to any degree?
Not really, no. As speaking of Flint, the biggest decrease we saw was in Flint. Their police budget was set to drop by $1.8 million. But Flint's mayor, Sheldon Neely, says that the city's overall deficit this year, and they worked hard to make sure they're not cutting any officers. The $1.8 million comes from mostly savings and health care plans, so no services will actually be affected.
And I'm very proud of the fact that hardworking men and women are out there every day, especially through a pandemic, to be able to provide a level of service.
Two cities are reducing staff. Ann Arbor is reducing its police force by 5 officers. Those are officer positions that are currently vacant. The city plans to increase staffing in its housing department and is currently working on a program to include social workers in responding to emergency calls.
So that is the flip side to calls to defund police departments, right? Activists say they want city leaders not just to take money out of the police budget, but to then put it into social services that they say would prevent the conditions that lead to crime. Nisa, are cities investing more in those services next year?
It seems that way, but it's not something that's going to happen overnight. The idea of including more social workers in responding to emergency calls has been relatively popular. Ann Arbor, Sterling Heights, Lansing, Livonia, and Grand Rapids all plan to add either social workers or other mental health professionals to their emergency response teams in the coming year. Outside of that, it's a bit difficult to track exactly what counts as social services in the city budget. It can include a lot of things in various departments, and it's not always reported by line by line.
For sure. Well, it sounds like some of these cities spend a lot more on policing than on other programs. Nisa, you dug into a little of the history there. What did you find?
Yeah, so University of Michigan professor Christian Davenport kind of explained this to us. He says it started in the late 1960s, where cities started bumping up the police budget in response to apparent rising crime, but also poverty. And at the same time, we saw the privatization of hospitals and mental health facilities getting shut down.
It's interesting, right? The defund conversation that we have now is simply a reallocation. Well, we had another reallocation then, and it was away from a bunch of these social services and towards the police. And then all we've seen basically that got institutionalized. And now we're trying to rejigger this kind of reallocation process. Unfortunately, it's taken place decades later.
And Davenport is also generally critical of the way governments here in the U.S. have kind of responded to people who experience economic hardship. He says that too often, the response is to over-police people in these communities.
Dustin, most cities have now, by this point, finalized their budgets for the next fiscal year, and planning for next year has already started. What comes next for the cities and, I guess, for the movement?
Yeah, budgeting in these cities really is kind of a year-round thing. So there will be amendments that will come up throughout the year, and it could change the funding for the police departments as the year goes on. One big thing is the pandemic rescue plan that will send a lot more money to cities. So there will be a lot of discussions about how to spend that money. But also, a lot of activists are looking for more structural changes, not just the year-to-year budget items, but to actually go in and change city charters. And this will be a big deal in a couple cities in Michigan. And it'll even be on the ballot as soon as this August. In Detroit, there's a charter revision commission that's been working for years and has already issued recommendations that could totally revamp policing in the city. That would include more oversight and a budget review of the police department's budget. But that ballot item, these recommendations, that is facing a challenge from the state attorney general over legal deficiencies. City voters in Detroit will get a chance to vote on those recommendations, but it's not clear yet how those will be implemented and what happens after the vote. And then also in Dearborn, there is a vote coming up in August where people can decide whether they want to reopen the city's charter and perhaps make changes to it. There are no recommendations for what those changes might mean, but voters will get a chance to say whether they want to take a look at it. And in Grand Rapids, where I live, activists are talking about changing the city charter. There's nothing really on the books yet. Or there's no timeline for that yet. But in Grand Rapids, there is a charter requirement that the police department gets no less than 32% of the city's general fund spending. So people who want to make a big difference in police department spending are really looking at that and looking at charter changes. And here's an example of one person, a woman named Allie, who's one of the activists in Grand Rapids who spoke at a Black Lives Matter rally this year.
We're going to keep going. All good things take a long time to happen. And if it takes us even longer, it's not going to stop us. We're not going to give up.
So as we've said, in the past year, there has not been major changes to many police department budgets in Michigan or any police department budgets in Michigan. But this is not slowing down the people who started this call last year. And there are things to keep an eye on as soon as this August.
Do you get the sense that a lot of the increases in police spending that you did find, that most of those were due to the charter conditions in cities like Grand Rapids and Dearborn and Detroit? I mean, how much of this is mandated and how much of it was discretionary?
Well, some of it was mandated, but not necessarily by charter. A lot of the increases we saw in cities were simply pay increases that were required in the union contracts, not exclusively, but you would see in the budgets, you say a 2 to 3% salary increase, salary and benefit increase for police officers. That was all agreed to in union contracts that were already put in place. So some of this, these personnel costs, were already sort of baked in. And if cities hadn't gone in and just flat out eliminated police officer positions, then the costs were set to rise. So, you know, you can figure in any city and really in any department, wages and salaries are going to go up most years. And so unless you're eliminating positions or just cutting things out of the budget, you could see naturally the budgets will just increase.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer and Nisa Khan. Dustin, Nisa, thank you so much for your work on this.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
You can find their story on police budgets in Michigan at michiganradio.org. We're curious to hear what you see happening in your town. Has there been any meaningful shift in the conversation about police and police funding? For that matter, what would meaningful look like to you? Maybe you've learned a few things as you've tuned in online for public meetings in a year when the pandemic made it tough to show up in person. You can always email your comments and questions, stuff that's on your mind. Our email address is stateside@michiganradio.org. The Michigan Radio Facebook page is also a good place to leave comments and thoughts. And you can hit us up on Twitter, too. Our handle is @statesideradio. Next up, what happens when trans men and women walk in to see a doctor?
The majority of medical students will receive, on average, over the 4 years of their residency, one single day where the needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people is discussed.
A Michigan sociologist has been chatting with MDs about this. We'll hear what they found after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Transgender medicine has generally focused on the process of transitioning. That's making sure that a person's physical characteristics align with their gender identity. It's less common for medicine to concern itself with what happens afterward. Steph Schuster is an assistant professor of sociology at Michigan State University and the author of the new book, Trans Medicine: The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender. And they join us today. Hey, Steph, glad you could be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
In the foreword of the book, you talk about how you identify as trans, and that you yourself found medical professionals that were affirming and positive when you were making your transition. But that there was this point in your life when you moved to another town, you had to choose another medical provider, and that was not really the case. Can you talk about what happened and what barriers you came up against?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we might need hours to go through, you know, the full litany of all the challenges I've had. But, you know, moving to a new town it can be stressful. You know, new job, new living situation, possibly leaving behind one's community. And I had found some providers and when I lived in Iowa City, and I worked with them, we got to know each other. We had, like, they just knew who I was as a person and as a patient. And I moved to a new city down to North Carolina. And it was like starting all over again, a new community, a new life, everything. I was starting my first job outside of my PhD program. And I just could not find, I mean, I think it took me a year to find a provider who was willing to work with me, not even someone who wanted to work with me. But I, you know, I kept having to vet doctors. So I'd call them up, I'd go into the clinic, I'd pay my copay, we'd sit down, and you know, I would start asking them questions about their familiarity with trans people. And they'd be like, oh, I'm totally willing to take you on as a patient. But for the gender stuff, you're going to have to go somewhere else. And it's, you know, it kind of confounded me. Because these were people that I had called up before I even stepped into their clinic and asked if they had worked with trans people. And all of the staff people kept saying, yes, 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 come on in and see the doctor. And I'd get in front of them and they would say, I can't do the gender stuff. So that, you know, like that, I mean, it can be really challenging. I'm trying to remember the statistics. I can't write offhand, but I mean, trans people are much less likely to go to the doctor for preventive care, to wait until the last minute possible when things become emergencies. And I think that, you know, like my experiences show us, at least for me, that it can be challenging to find providers. So,
I mean, having someone say that to you, that I'll be happy to take care of you for all your medical needs, except this one thing. I mean, we do go to different doctors for different specialties, but what was the implication there for you that this piece of your health that's sort of fundamental to your physical body was not considered normal?
Yeah, I mean, that was the way that I felt. I mean, I don't want to speak in the past tense. It still happens. When I hear those kinds of things from doctors, what I translate to in my brain is, you are so different and so out there that I'm not going to work with you, because there's sometimes it feels like there's a problem with you, right? But sometimes it feels like you're just so abnormal. I don't know how to do that stuff. In some ways it feels exoticizing, right? Like you're so different and so out there. Like, I just don't know how to make sense of you. It's like they cannot translate their medical knowledge into working with trans people. So I'll give you a quick example. I was speaking with a gynecologist, and she was, you know, pretty early in her time working with trans people. And she said something that was quite like that, right? Like, I just don't know anything about this. And I was like, well, help me understand here, because as a gynecologist, you do work with hormones. So what is it about trans people? And my question, you know, it wasn't a gotcha question. I really just wanted to know her thought process. And I saw it happen on her face where she was like, oh my gosh, I never made that connection.
The providers that you interviewed described experiencing a kind of existential crisis when trans people show up in their clinics and their consulting rooms. What exactly is it about the experience that's so unnerving for them?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, if we think about medical providers, they're trained to diagnose and to work with patients who have illness and disease. And when trans people show up in their clinics asking for gender-affirming interventions, such as hormone therapy or sometimes surgery, it requires a different way of thinking about patient care, because being trans is not an illness or disease. And so they're working, you know, providers have to work from healthcare training to work with a gender identity. And for some providers, that just creates a lot of uncertainty. It conflicts with how they think of medicine. If they're not treating an illness or disease, then what precisely is their role?
Right. What did you learn about how medical professionals are taught to manage and respond to uncertainty? I guess even just framing it as managing uncertainty kind of says something there, doesn't it?
Yeah, so they are trained to some degree, right? And they have credentialing, they have licensing, they go through education, they acquire all of this, you know, clinical experience and knowledge. And part of that training helps them manage uncertainty. It helps them make quick decisions when needed. But again, there is something that's a little different about trans medicine, or really any new areas of medicine, when providers can't, you know, look to the diagnostic criteria, or they can't look to clinical guidelines, and they aren't able to knock on their colleagues' doors or ask for help because for new areas of medicine, no one really knows. And so what I find in trans medicine is, unfortunately, sometimes in response to that uncertainty, medical providers will kind of double down on their authority and go back to, you know, like an old 1950s style of medicine where doctor knows best. And that's where a lot of conflict starts happening between trans patients and medical providers.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Steph Schuster. They're an assistant professor of sociology at Michigan State University and the author of a new book, Trans Medicine, The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender. How does the medical community sort of conceive of its role in trans medicine? Do you think that that's still very much grounded in ideas that trans people need and will be looking for surgical interventions or the, you know, maybe the mental health care aspect of it that you just mentioned?
I think there's more medical providers who are aware that, you know, for those who are not specializing in trans medicine, so your family care provider, the endocrinologist, the gynecologist, whomever, that their trans patients may seek gender-affirming care, and they also have the health needs of every other person, right? So trans people also get pink eye. Trans people also break their bones. So right. I think that one change that has been fairly significant over maybe just the last decade is the medical establishment having more intentional conversations about not only offering gender specific care, but also how to work with trans people that is free of bias.
Right. So is this something that you see becoming more a part of mainstream medical education?
Oh, yeah, I wish. Not yet. So, I mean, if we think about, you know, I mean, the medical curriculum is so packed already. Like, there's so much that medical students have to learn. And the majority of medical students will receive, on average, over the 4 years of their residency, one single day where the needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people is discussed. So they don't get a lot of specific training. And I think that that kind of adds to some of the uncertainty that we've already talked about.
I know that a lot of your project had to do with just asking doctors about, you know, how their conversations go, what their clinical guidelines look like. But if you got to that point in the conversation, how did you talk to physicians about rethinking their process and their approach? What do you think should happen?
Yeah, so, you know, in the interviews, I ended with a question that, you know, after speaking with them for 90 minutes and all of the challenges and the uncertainties, the anxieties, I wanted to end on an up note. So I asked, can you share with me some of the joyful aspects of working with trans people? And the responses they offered were amazing. Providers talked about how, yes, there are a lot of challenges, but they feel in the process of working with trans people, they actually become, from their perspective, they become better doctors. So for example, you know, one provider was talking about how one of the challenges he faces as a family care physician is that the time that he has with patients has become so limited, right? I mean, mm-hmm. like 12 minutes for each patient. And with trans people, because of the historic harms, a lot of providers slow it down, have more time, build rapport and trust. And what they found is that they got to know their patients better, and they started wanting to do that with all of their patients, right? So yes, like there are a lot of challenges, but I think that in asking providers and only focusing on challenges, we miss out. And by flipping it a little bit and asking about the joys, they had a lot to say about that too.
Yeah. I don't want to overstate what's happening across the United States right now, but we are living in an era in which trans people are becoming a bit more self-aware and sometimes encouraged to, you know, explore who they are a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And there are places in Michigan where we can find, you know, school-age kids who are identifying as trans. I was very curious to know if you think something is going on through primary care doctor or family care doctor's experiences with younger trans people.
Yeah, so I spoke with a handful of family care physicians who worked with youth. And I had never thought about how if you're working with minors, you also have to negotiate with the parents or the guardians. And so it was the pediatric physicians who, they were some of the fiercest providers about, you know, wanting to make sure that trans youth were thriving, that they were healthy, that their needs were being met. And sometimes that also meant having to teach parents about what it means to have a trans kid. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes in a lot of these public conversations happening right now in state legislators, that are starting to ban providers from working with trans youth, that the story that they seem to think is like what happens is that a trans kid wakes up one day and is like, I want to transition. And then they go to the doctor that same day and start getting on hormones. And that's just not how it happens. Right.
Right.
So I think that a lot of these conversations come from fears and misunderstandings and a little bit of a paternalistic stance that somehow state legislators know what's better for trans youth than trans youth.
Or their doctors.
Or other doctors. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Steph, could we just pull back for a minute and talk about what the big picture looks like for trans health? I mean, is there anything we can say about how trans people experience healthcare inequalities because of some of the biases that they find when they visit a doctor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's not the scholarship points to it's not great. And trans people do continue to experience a lot of discrimination. So sometimes it's explicit, right? Having providers tell them that they need to find someone else because they don't want to work with them or can't work with them, even if it's for, you know, like a everyday concern outside
basic
of
stuff.
Gender.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. There have been reports. I've seen fewer recently, but, you know, a trans person needs emergency care and EMTs walking away because they don't know what to do with the trans person. So those are like, you know, pretty explicit forms of discrimination. But I think that sometimes it's also implicit. So right now I'm working on another project with a colleague and we're speaking with trans people about their health experiences. And one of the questions we ask is, do you have any experiences with providers making assumptions about you based on your gender? And the responses that we get are, I mean, some of them are really troubling. So for example, a lot of our trans respondents are sharing that sometimes providers focus so much on the transness of their trans patients that trans people don't feel like they're getting any of their other healthcare needs met, right? So like you show up at the doctor's office for your annual and for 15 minutes, the entire conversation is about why you're on estrogen, how long you've been on estrogen. Do you know the problems with estrogen? Like those, like that line of questions. We also have a lot of trans people talking about how they've never been asked about their sexual health. And I think that part of that is because for a long time, gender and sexuality were conflated. They were assumed to be one and the same. And so sometimes providers forget to think about how trans people have sexual health needs too, right?
Steph, was there anything else I didn't ask you that you think is important for us to talk about?
I just want to, I guess, reiterate that a lot of what I'm finding, I think, is reflective of broader concerns in medicine in general, right? So if we go back to January and February 2020, One of the reasons why it felt so chaotic is because the medical establishment was presented with a virus that they really didn't know much about. And all of those uncertainties and all of those concerns and fears, it really showed us some of the vulnerabilities of the medical establishment in responding to new things like new illnesses, new diseases. But at the same time that I say that, I'm also thinking about, we have to remember that being trans is not an illness. I think that there's hope. I think there's optimism that providers are, as they learn more about trans people and trans medicine, that they're not treating trans people as if they're an illness or disease. But we still have quite a ways to go.
Steph Schuster is a medical sociologist and assistant professor at Michigan State University. Their new book is called Trans Medicine: The Emergence and Practice of Treating Gender. Steph, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
In a moment, Governor Whitmer announces she's lifting the public health rules for being out and about in Michigan.
Looks like it's back to normal, whatever normal is now in June of 2021.
That story after we come back. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There are a number of different workforces around Michigan who have people coming to work with relatively low vaccination rates. A recent story in Bridge, Detroit notes that less than half of the city's police department is vaccinated. While that's concerning, it's certainly not out of line with Detroit's overall vaccination rate. Bryce Huffman reported this story for Bridge, and he joins us now. Hey, Bryce.
How's it going, April?
All right. Let's start with the police department. You spoke with an assistant chief for your story. What did he have to say to you about why the rate is so low among officers?
I think one of the things that Assistant Chief Bettison really wanted to reiterate to me time and time again during the interview and after and even before it was that the police department is made up of the people who live in the Detroit area, right? So if you look at the city of Detroit's overall rate, it's, you know, below 37%. So he wanted to make the point that police officers are just like regular people. They have the same fears and concerns and motivations for wanting or not wanting the vaccine as every other Detroiter.
It sounds like vaccination rates on the force may be a little bit higher than off the force, considering the numbers in your story.
Yeah, just a bit higher. The department's rate sits right around 39%. The city's is just below 37%. And I think part of that is the police were able to get the vaccine before other people because, you know, they are considered first responders. So they've actually had access to the vaccine since December, which is when Assistant Chief Bettison got his first shot of the vaccine.
Were you able to find out if vaccination rates are the same among police who live in the city and people who might live outside the city but who work in Detroit?
I haven't been able to get that data from the police department, but it has been speculated by people in the department that people who live outside the city are a little bit more likely to get the vaccine. If you look at the numbers for Wayne County overall, it's much higher than just the city of Detroit. So and Oakland County and Macomb County. So the surrounding areas are higher than the city of Detroit. The thinking is people in Detroit have a lot of reasons to be hesitant to get the vaccine, particularly people who might not trust the federal government or the healthcare industry right now. And I think that has contributed to the rates we're seeing in the city. So officers who might live in a place like, I don't know, Redford or Livonia might be more likely to get it than people who live, you know, just 10 or 15 minutes away in Detroit.
Yeah. I want to get into that a little bit more. But first, let me ask, do you get any sense that the Detroit Police Department has any interest in mandating that officers will have to be vaccinated to come to work?
No, I've talked to the police about it. Assistant Chief Bettison and Interim Chief James White have both said that forcing officers to get the vaccine would open up a can of worms that they just aren't prepared to open, and they're not particularly interested in opening. They want to let everyone on the force know that their health rights are theirs, and that it, you know, getting the vaccine, while they encourage it, is up to the individuals in the department. What they have said, though, is that the city is looking into ways to kind of organize which officers are going to be kind of on the front lines and which ones won't, around, you know, who has been vaccinated, just because that is a safety concern in the city right now.
That's interesting. Bryce, law enforcement was hit early and hit pretty hard when COVID first started spreading. Former Chief James Craig had it. Wayne County's late sheriff, Benny Napoleon, died after contracting COVID. Do you think that the hesitancy on the force is any different than the hesitancy in the rest of the city?
I think it's different in the sense that as police officers, they are tasked with keeping people safe. So their hesitancy to get the vaccine has kind of, you know, more immediate implications for the city overall than, let's say, like an average citizen. For instance, if I, as a journalist who, you know, has been working from home for a long time, was very hesitant to get the vaccine, that would be different than a police officer who is being tasked with breaking up summer crowds or helping people get to the hospital. But I think the reasons for the hesitancy are largely the same, even if the impact might, you know, look very different.
Yeah. And just to get into that a little bit more, I mean, these may be folks who, despite the fact that they are police officers, may have received disparate treatment through the healthcare system.
I think one of the things that has been interesting is, despite the fact that the department's vaccination rate is so low, you know, they've had access to it for over 6 months now. They've had access to the vaccine before anyone else really in the city. You know, senior citizens, even at the time when the vaccine was first administered, you know, couldn't get it before first responders and before city officials. So to me, it has always been kind of a weird, you know, like, why not take advantage of the opportunity? But also, I fully understand why some people might be hesitant about getting a vaccine where they, you know, simply might not know the science or might not know the effects of it. And that's another interesting thing. The department actually had health officials come and talk to officers who were interested in learning more about the vaccine. I think, you know, despite those efforts, though, vaccine hesitancy is just something that, you know, it's a symptom of many, many different reasons that people in Detroit, particularly Black people and people coming from low-income communities, just don't really have that trust in institutions right now.
Yeah. Bryce, if we look at the broader picture, have you heard about any individual businesses that have tried to mandate vaccines for their employees and whether they've had any success with that?
I've heard of a few that have discussed it. I was actually just talking to a friend of mine. I don't want to say the business because they haven't gone through with it, but they discussed requiring people to be vaccinated before returning to work. And I think that one of the things that occurred was they looked at the legality of requiring it. And some businesses, you know, might be willing to risk legality and legal challenges, while others are a little bit more timid about it just because the financial impact that the pandemic had on them. So it's something that I think eventually businesses will kind of require as, you know, the pandemic starts to slow down. They'll require it, you know, the same way that teachers are required to have CPR certification or nurses are required to have their TB shots, you know, things that we don't really think about anymore, but, you know, are requirements for certain jobs.
I keep thinking of the fact that there are an awful lot of people in Detroit who lost someone to COVID over the past year and a half. And despite that fact, many survivors who are all too aware of the risks of this are still hesitant. What do you make of that? Do you see them turning to maybe other protective measures to try to be mindful about keeping safe in other ways, even though they're hesitant about the vaccine?
Yeah, I think I know a lot of people who are hesitant to get the vaccine, like way more people than I would have maybe anticipated at the start of the pandemic. But One of the things that I think a lot of people who don't want the vaccine are doing is a lot of these people in Detroit anyway are still wearing masks. They are still, you know, keeping distance. They are still being very diligent about washing their hands and rubbing down surfaces and washing their clothes. While I think on the flip side of that, people who have been vaccinated, you know, fully vaccinated, are not necessarily as diligent anymore. So it's kind of a weird balance where, you know, they might be worried about the vaccine for lots of different reasons, but, you know, they're still going to be safe and they're still going to do what they can to kind of keep themselves and the people around them safe, even if, you know, they might have worries about getting any of the different vaccines.
What do you hear from city and county officials about the low vaccination rate in the city at large? Is there any more talk about a response or rethinking and redoubling vaccination efforts?
I've heard from one source that the vaccination efforts themselves are not the problem per se. It's the way in which information about these efforts was being administered. And what they told me was that, you know, the city and the county can only do so much when people don't necessarily have trust in these systems right now. And I think the entire year of 2020 gave a lot of people a renewed skepticism of some of these institutions. But, you know, another source told me almost the opposite. It's that, you know, like, yeah, maybe we need to rethink how we did this. And maybe if someone told us, you know, back when we started trying all of these different outreach efforts, you know, what our rates would be, we might have rethought how we, you know, went about it. But as it stands, I think part of the low vaccination rate does come from how it was rolled out. You know, certain populations hadn't been tested yet, and people weren't even sure the vaccine was safe for kids, or, you know, lots of misinformation about kids not even needing to get vaccinated. I think all of those things contributed to the rates we're seeing in Detroit and the rates we're seeing statewide.
The other piece of the vaccine rollout is the fact that it was sort of a point of sale. It was available to folks who could get to a drugstore or a grocery store, or a limited, you know, number of places like Ford Field where people were able to get to it. Right. But I do wonder if that approach is being questioned now.
Yeah, I think one of the things you have to remember about the city of Detroit is, although, you know, we're the Motor City, there's still lots of Detroiters who don't drive cars. There's still lots of Detroiters who rely on public transportation. And when you have a vaccine rollout plan that, you know, is a drive-through basically, and it's in a part of the city that, you know, it's in downtown, and it's in a part of the city where maybe it does take a little bit of effort for people to get there, and maybe it does take a little bit more planning and organizing to get people from the farther corners of the city down there. You're going to see some difficulties, and you're going to have lower turnout than maybe you expected, because you think of downtown as like a central location, but for a lot of people, it's actually not. You know, it's on the southern edge of the city. If you live somewhere like, I don't know, the Brightmoor area or even Rosedale Park, you know, it's not the closest place to where you actually live. So if you're someone who doesn't have a car or can't necessarily just take off work to get down there, you know, like, you're kind of out of luck. And I think that's something that there were people who were making that point before the vaccine rollout. But understandably, I think the city was like, well, this is us, you know, putting our best foot forward right now. And with hindsight, obviously, I think they would, you know, try to do a little bit better of a job meeting people where they're at. And right now they're actually rolling out vaccines where they're actually going to people's houses, which is something that I think, you know, is a great idea, and maybe that's something they could have looked into more before they went with the strategy they went with. But again, I think that's one of those things where hindsight is 2020.
Bryce, this is such an odd time for a lot of people. The state is officially reopening today. And rates are low compared with where they have been. But we also know that testing rates are low and everybody's pretty cooped up. And there are many businesses, as we've heard, that are dealing with staffing issues because they're just to the point that they're not even sure if they can accommodate all the customers who are going to show up this summer. Anything else on your mind or anything else you notice about the vibe in the city?
You know, it's weird because last year when I first moved back to Detroit, it felt like I wasn't in my hometown anymore. You know, like everything was really closed down. I couldn't see a lot of people. So it felt like I wasn't back home quite yet. But now as things are opening up, the pandemic's not over, right? But like the tone that people have is that even if things aren't perfect, they're getting better. And I think that, you know, especially for the beginning of summer, for things to feel like, oh my God, we're finally turning over that corner. Some people are just ready to pretend that this is over and, you know, look at it only through the positive lens. There are some others who are very almost hyper-digilant about it still. And they're like, no, it's not over. It's okay to, you know, see more people, but you still have to be careful. And I see a lot of people who are kind of bouncing between those two feelings. And I myself kind of am, you know, as I'm fully vaccinated and most of my friends and family are, I am fatigued of not seeing people and not being able to go out and do things. But then I also have to remember, you know, there are people, particularly in my apartment building where it's mostly older folks, who I need to be diligent for, and who I need to be, safe so I don't get them sick or I don't, you know, spread this virus to them and their families. So I think right now the tone in the city is, you know, we're kind of celebrating almost too early. And that is causing some people, myself included, to just be a little bit cautious.
Bryce Huffman, you can read his reporting online at Bridge Detroit. Bryce, it's such a pleasure to hear your voice. Hope you have a good summer.
It's great to hear yours as well, and hopefully you enjoy your summer as well.
Today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer lifted almost all public health restrictions related to how we do business, how we socialize, and other aspects of public life in Michigan. Rick Pluta covers government and politics for Michigan's public radio stations, and he was at the announcement today. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
So it looks like many of the things that we've become accustomed to doing, wearing masks in public, keeping some distance, are no longer required, yes?
Yes, it looks like it's back to normal, whatever normal is now in June of 2021.
Yeah. Why did the governor say that she's doing this?
Well, she said it's because our infection rates are low and that, you know, more and more people are being vaccinated, even though we have not reached that critical 70% number that is, you know, basically the signal that we've reached herd immunity. So she said that the direction is good, and so it's time to lift restrictions.
Rick, last summer at this time, Michigan also had very low case rates. But when the fall rolled around, spikes started happening in infection rates. And by winter, we were in worse shape than we'd been before. Did the governor have anything to say about the long term?
She tap danced past that question, but she did say that she's not going to give up emergency power authority, despite an assault on those powers by the legislature, who Republicans think that she went too far for too long in terms of restrictions and orders, but is hoping, like all of us, that the vaccines will be adequate protection against variants, that the caseloads will remain low enough that we can deal with surges as they happen, and that hopefully, you know, we can get back, you know, we can get on with the business of a economic recovery and figuring out how to spend COVID dollars from the federal government in order to accomplish that.
Rick Pluta is Capital Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.